Well, they'll tell you that it's violence to destroy a logging truck. These are the very people who'd kill the planet for a buck. They'll tell you to talk and be reasonable. They'll say, maybe we can talk tomorrow, but we can pull the GM crops today. So here's a toast to the night. Three cheers and a grunt. To the Earth Liberation Front. The Earth Liberation Front.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Dave Rovics and the Earth Liberation Front to introduce this week's show about the World Bank on the brink of making a multi-million dollar loan to South Africa's peristatal Electricity Supply Commission, or ESKOM. What does it mean when the World Bank, with the stated goal of reducing poverty, provides funds to build coal-fired power plants that are anything but clean? When the true externalized costs are counted, coal is anything but cheap. For many decades, coal has supplied about 45% of the fuel from which electricity is generated, and we surely know by now that clean coal is a buzzword that will keep us on the same trajectory of fossil fuel pollution.
Well, there are so many things of beauty in this world to see. A wild running river, or an old-growth redwood tree. But in such an ugly...
Coal reserves are available in almost every country worldwide, with recoverable reserves in around 70 countries. At current production levels, proven coal reserves are estimated to last 122 years. In contrast, proven oil and gas reserves are equivalent to around 42 and 60 years at current production levels, respectively. Over 67% of oil and 66% of gas reserves are concentrated in the Middle East and Russia. The World Bank is an international financial institution that provides leverage loans to developing countries for capital programs. With the stated goal of reducing poverty, the World Bank is one of five institutions created at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. The conference was attended by delegates from many countries, although the most powerful countries in attendance were the United States and the United Kingdom, which dominated negotiations. The International Monetary Fund, or IMF, was one of the five institutions, and both the IMF and the World Bank are based in Washington, D.C. The World Bank is by custom headed by an American, while the IMF is led by a European. Unlike the World Bank Group, the World Bank comprises two institutions, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which is the IBRD, and the International Development Association, which is also known as the IDA, whereas the IMF incorporates these two in addition to three more. Now, in finance, the term leverage refers to the use of debt to supplement investment. Companies usually leverage to increase returns to stock, as this practice can maximize gains and losses. The easy but high risk increases in stock prices due to leveraging at banks in the United States have been blamed for an unusually high rate of pay for top executives during our current financial crisis, since gains in stock are often rewarded regardless of method. Now, South Africa has one of the most intensive energy economies in the world. Its state-run electricity supplier, ESKOM, predominantly uses locally mined coal to power this energy, and since 2008 has been facing an electricity crisis due to demands for power exceeding supply. In January, I was in South Africa when NERSA, the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, agreed to a rate hike of 25% for each of the next 3 years, and this falls largely on ordinary people and not on industries that have the most benefit from cheap electricity. In addition, South Africa is hoping that the World Bank will see its way clear to grant a $3.75 billion loan to ESKOM. If approved, the majority of the funds, over $3 billion, will go toward the construction of the 4,800-megawatt Medupi power plant, which is set to be the world's fourth-largest coal-fired power plant. Medupi will add an estimated 25 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions per year to ESKOM's 40% share of South Africa's overall total greenhouse gas emissions. The project is part of a 5-year, $50 billion expansion plan by ESKOM to increase generation capacity in South Africa. So much opposition is being voiced around the world to this proposed bill that South Africa's finance minister, Pravin Gordhan, wrote an op-ed piece in Monday, March 22nd's Washington Post editorial. He states, Because this is not the most auspicious time for our energy utility Eskom to be looking to finance a $50 billion capital program, we are approaching sources of funding we have hitherto left untapped, including the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Investment Bank. But our application for a $3.75 billion World Bank loan faces stiff opposition. A strong body of opinion holds that multilateral development banks should be discouraged from funding coal burning power projects with carbon dioxide emissions that contribute to climate change. We share this concern, but after careful consideration, we have concluded that the course we have chosen is the only responsible way forward. He continues, this is Pravin Gordhan, the minister, South Africa's finance minister, writing in the Washington Post. He continues, the bulk of the loan, or just over $3 billion, will go toward the construction of a 4,800-megawatt power station at Medupi in South Africa's Limpopo province. This plant, the first of its kind in Africa, will use some of the most efficient, lowest-emission coal-fired technology available. The rest of the loan, $745 million, will be invested in wind and concentrated solar power projects, each generating 100 megawatts, and in various other efficiency improvements. That was Pravin Gordhan, the South African finance minister. Now with me today is Sunita Dube, the Washington, D.C. representative of the South African environmental organization Groundwork. Welcome, Sunita.
Hello, Susan.
It's great to have you with us today, and I want to talk about this editorial that Pravin Gordhan just had published in the Washington Post. He's writing that the plan for the funding includes these clean coal-burning power plants, and he says it faces stiff opposition. What is the opposition about?
I think one thing which really need to clear is that there is a whole issue around this is a supercritical power plant, and it's going to burn clean coal, but the issue is that where are you going to get this coal from? And I think whether it's finance minister or everyone talking about this very efficient coal power plant, in their definition, they're not talking about where the coal is going to come from. And even if it is going to have this supercritical technology, this plant will not have any CCS, which is carbon capture and storage, to control or to capture the carbon dioxide, which is going to be emitted by this coal power plant, which is 25 million metric tons a year.
25 million metric tons of coal?
Of carbon dioxide
A
year is going to be emitted from this coal power plant. And there are lots of environmental issues around coal power plant in terms of mercury. There's a lot of mercury emissions from coal. There's a lot of the sulfur which comes when you burn this coal. And currently the way this plant is proposed, there is no technology in place right now to place these sulfur scrubbers, which are going to capture the sulfur, which is a big component for acid rains and all that. So I think all I want to say is that on one hand, finance minister is saying that this is a very clean coal, the picture he's painting, but he's only telling the half truth. He's not telling the full story that there are so many other environmental issues which comes with burning coal. So when you tell the whole story, then this dirty coal is not so clean, and there are a lot of impacts on environment, on people's health, which have been recorded all over the world, what happens to people who live in and around these big coal-fired power plants.
And at this point, what does it look like for the loan going through? Does it look as though it's going to happen? Can you tell from what you're hearing?
The recent information we have is that the voting is scheduled for April 8th, where all the executive directors at the World Bank are going to vote for this loan.
They will vote. They will vote for it. Is that what you're saying?
The loan is going to come for vote. We just we have no information as to how these executive directors are going to vote. We have in the past weeks weeks, we have met a lot of these executive directors who represent various countries at the World Bank, including the United States. And we have raised our concerns with them. We have raised the issues why there are so many non-civil society organizations and community groups who are opposing this power plan, because it is neither good for people and it's not good for environment, and there is no access to electricity as claimed by World Bank and the South African government. So there are so many issues around it which have not still been answered, so we are surprised that this vote is still going to be on April 8th, which is a very short time, given that we have raised so many concerns around that. And most likely, as previously U.S. government has done, is they have abstained in when the vote was for Africa Development Bank, and the knowledge we have is that they are going to abstain, but abstaining is not going to stop this project. So we are requesting, and we have been requesting different executive directors to vote no on this loan, so that this loan doesn't go, is not rushed through. And even we have said the same thing to the World Bank management when we had meeting with them.
And let's talk a little bit about Eskom. I was most recently in South Africa, and during the NERSA hearings, the National Energy Regulator of South Africa was going around the country doing different hearings, different meetings for people to get engaged. And I think they had about 10 of these meetings. And part of the issue was to get permission, quote, to, and that's my word, permission, by the people to raise the electricity rates by, they were asking for 35%. By the time I left the country, they had actually received 25%. And that's for a 25% rate increase for the next, for this year, next year, and the year after. And there's been a tremendous pushback from the people in South Africa, many of whom simply cannot afford this. It later came out that some of the companies that are benefiting from these, from this very cheap electricity, are paying almost nothing. Let's talk a little bit about Eskom and its approach here.
I think it's very interesting that, you know, when you talk about these kind of democratic processes of NERSA having these meetings all over the country to discuss the electricity rate hike, and it's not a secret that there are people, there were a lot of opposition to these rate hikes, and people have said that they will not be able to afford the new electricity prices, which would also mean that there are a lot of people who are going to fall off the grid, because the choice is going to be supporting your family or buying electricity. And so I think interesting thing is that Eskom, on one hand, has raised electricity, household electricity prices by 25% for next 3 years, which in total is 190% increase. And when it is asking this loan from the World Bank, it is said that this big project is to provide access to electricity to poor people. So there's so much of dichotomy in their approach to say that on one hand they have increased electricity prices to such, it's like skyrocketing, and on other hand they are saying that, oh, by the way, we are asking World Bank to give this money to build Medupi power plant so that we can provide electricity to all the 20% of the population of South Africa who doesn't have. But on the other hand, they have raised 25% electricity rates for next 3 years. So I think there is a dichotomy in what they are asking for, and it definitely makes the agenda of Eskom very clear that the ground reality is that this power plant is not for the poor people. This is for supplying the energy intensive corporations in South Africa, like the mining industry and smelters. And they have been protecting these multinational corporations through special purchasing agreements, and nobody knows that at what cheap rate these electricity companies are being provided electricity, and sometimes it's even below cost of production.
Let me just remind our listeners, we're talking with Sunita Dube about the Eskom, South Africa's parastatal energy company, requesting up to $50 billion from the World Bank to continue to dig up coal, basically, and burn it. When I was there, there's a lot of talk about transparency, that everybody can see what's going on in government and so forth. And it was therefore very dismaying to learn, after this rate hike had been already decided upon, that some of these contracts, agreements with the big companies, were in fact the opposite of transparent. Some of them had even remained from the apartheid era. And there's no information at all coming out, as you say, about how much these companies are actually paying and running smelters. I mean, smelters use up an enormous amount of electricity. And at the same time, there's a discussion that South Africa will be, is, and is intending to go towards renewables, but it sort of flies in the face of what they're actually doing here.
I strongly feel, and that's something which the local civil society groups in South Africa feel, that there is not a very honest discussion around who this electricity is going to be for, whether it is at the World Bank or it is with Eskom. It feels that the poor people are being used to get this loan, whereas they are not going to get this loan in light of this new electricity rate hike. And secondly, I think the whole point which even the finance minister makes in his op-ed is that they are doing so much on renewables. And if you look at the overall loan, it's the minuscule part of that, 7% of that goes for renewable. And even in the past, when it has come to the Eskom's will to invest in renewables, it has shown very poorly on Eskom, where they had a pilot wind project which they inaugurated with big fanfare, but it has always remained pilot project and nothing has happened on that. They were supposed to put solar water heaters. There were like millions of solar water heaters were supposed to be installed in South African homes. Some thousands were installed, and that program was not even successful. So they can claim on paper that they are moving towards a renewable, or they can falsely claim that this big loan for Marubi Coal Power Plant is a down payment for the greener future. But their actions tell the different story. There has not been any honest investment or looking at the renewables. And given the fact that South Africa is endowed with solar and wind potential, so we do question that if they are so interested in renewables, then they should be talking about renewables and like scaling the renewables and really transitioning towards a sustainable energy path, which is not going to be if we keep on being dependent on coal. And one thing to note here is that this Marubi power plant is not something which get approved and is forgotten. This is going to stay for next 40 to 50 years, which means that South Africa is going to lock its future in coal for next 40 to 50 years. So this is not a transition, and I think that's something which we have also been raising here in South Africa and also in DC, that if this is a transition, then South Africa is never going to be on renewables, because they will always be addicted to cheap coal.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the group that Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said, quote, he called South Africa, along with Brazil, India, and China, the four horsemen of a climate change solution. And he bases that on what happened at Copenhagen. The four horsemen of the climate change solution, that actually comes from, I think, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a kind of interesting, I don't even know what to call it. It's not exactly a slip of the tongue. He's thought about that, apparently, the four horsemen of a climate change solution. Working with Brazil, India, and China, what can South Africa do? What is South Africa doing?
I think everyone knows that there is no serious commitment on the Copenhagen Accord. And given that, whether it's China or India or South Africa, and it's very interesting to see that these are the economies who are highly dependent on coal. So It's very ironical to say that these are the leaders in so-called the climate change negotiation or the climate change dialogue, whereas they are heavily dependent on coal as for running their economy. And whether it's China or India, they keep building their coal power plants. China builds one coal power plant every week almost. So being called the four horsemen for whatever reason, whether it's China or India or South Africa, there's like no leadership to say that, yes, we are going to transition to renewable energies, or we are going to commit to say that we will stop our further future investment in coal and we will look into wind and solar and other renewable potentials we have in our country. So on one hand, these countries can keep on saying that what they are doing, and I think that's what also is an issue of concern, that whatever you want to say on papers or at international forum, but if you don't apply and if it is not, your implementation is totally, is contrary to what you say at the international forum, it doesn't mean anything. You can be four horsemen for Copenhagen Accord or whatever, but if you're planning to build three largest coal power plants in the world in your country, I think it says something, which is that nobody, that South Africa is not serious about its climate change or its CO2 emissions or its commitment. So I think we have to see whether these words which are said as these by politicians actually matches their action within their own countries.
Well, actually, each of these countries, Brazil, China, India, and South Africa, have at least one thing in common besides abundance of coal. They have a large population of poor or underemployed or unemployed people. In South Africa, mm-hmm. there's a 24% at least level of unemployment. So they're really in some ways stuck between a rock and a hard place, pardon the pun, to get jobs.
I think, you know, with any new project which comes up, there is always this issue of, like, job creation, and there'll be so many people who will get job, and it is suddenly going to be changed, the, like, whole poverty situation, in whether it's in India, China, or in South Africa. And even if you look at the job creation, I think it has been, if you calculate it, anybody can say that, will tell you that these mega projects like the coal power plants, they don't produce as much job as a renewable energy project is going to produce. So there are more green jobs created, and if one wants to go towards the path of renewables, and if anybody wants to provide electricity to their poor people, which is, I think, people, groups like ours and the groundwork, and also who are supporting this us in this initiative, we all agree that access to electricity for poor is something which is very critical. Nobody is denying that that should not be done. But is this the right way to do it? And I think that's something which we are questioning, that if anybody wants to provide access, if any of these countries want to provide access to electricity to poor people, you don't need such big, massive, centralized power plants. The renewable energy in a very small, decentralized way can very well cater to the needs of poor people, and is much more sustainable and can create jobs for the communities. And there are lots of projects which have proven that, you know, they're at that such small-scale renewable energy, renewable projects can be very, very useful for providing energy, electricity to the poor communities. So there's no misunderstanding in terms of providing access to electricity to poor people, but we disagree with the fact that the big coal power plants are the solution or are the way forward to do this.
Is it a fact that Eskom is just doing what it's always done, and it really doesn't have the ability or the capacity right now to turn around and to start doing things a different way?
I think whether it's Eskom or it's World Bank, there is definitely business as usual. And yes, coal is, they say that it's the cheapest and the most viable energy, electricity they can, like, source to produce electricity. Yes, it is very cheap and viable because we don't include the true cost of coal, because we try to externalize a lot of cost on communities and in the environment. So if you take into account all the external costs, like the impacts on air, water, and also the health impacts on communities, I think coal is not a very cheap solution. Is it an easy solution? Yes, it is a very easy solution, because South Africa has lots of coal, so does India, and so does China. And I think what is lacking is the political will to move away from business as usual and do something which is more creative. And nobody is saying that the change is going to be easy, but the question is whether this change is necessary if we want to survive and if we want to leave this world for our future generation. And I think that's a choice which politicians and decision makers have to take, whether doing business as usual is the right approach and drowning the whole world is something which we should do, or look at the very short-term gains and forget what the long-term impacts are going to be of this project, or to make an effort or to have to create an environment where we change the way we do business, which is we look at different ways, we look at different energy mixes, we look at wind, we look at solar, and or the biogas. So there are different ways of doing things, but I think it's not that this cannot be done, but I do feel that there is a lack of political will and nobody wants to take that first step.
Sunita, how can people learn more? How can they get involved? How can they pressure the World Bank to reconsider? What is something that people can do?
There are a lot of ways, and people have been doing this. If people are in South Africa, they can write to their elected officials and say why they are concerned about this project. If people in the U.S. want to raise issues around this project, then they can log on to this website called of Sierra Club, which is www.sierraclub.org/South Africa, and they can go and they can learn more about the ESCOM project and the issues around it and why more than 70 groups are opposing this project from South Africa. And there are online petitions which they can sign, and they can send a letter to their elected representative, and they can also send a letter to the U.S. Treasury, which is going to take a decision on this vote in the World Bank.
It's April 8th, is that what you said?
Yes, April 8th. So I would say if for people to just take a quick action and write sign on these online petitions, just go onto this website and just take some action.
That's the Sierra Club website. I'll put that link on our website too, raisingsandradio.org. And before we leave it at that, in this case, the Sierra Club, I think some of the environmental groups don't always agree with the Sierra Club, but in this case, there seems to be a real coherence around this one issue.
That the groups like Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth and Bank Information Center, and I think all of us, we do believe that dirty coal is not the solution. It's not something which is a 21st century solution in trying to solve issues around the challenges which we are going to face because of the global warming. And it might not seem, but I think the impacts of global warming are very real. And there are times when people think of this as more like a north and a south issue, that southern countries have a right to develop. But I think the more important question is to develop at what cost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, even, yes, there are historical injustices done in terms of north using a lot of fossil fuel and all that, but I think it's a common problem, and the solutions also have to be common and at global level, where everyone has to take their own share. So that's why we have support of a lot of international groups and groups like Sierra Club and Bank Information Center, Friends of the Earth, and also some more than 70 groups from South Africa, faith groups, labor unions, small community groups, and women's groups. So I think a very interesting part of this campaign is the different stakeholders who are going to be affected by this project and who are opposing this project, whether it's the unions or faith-based groups or women's groups or groups working on very different issues, but kind of like they are agreeing on one thing, that coal is not the way forward. Mm.
Sunita Dubey, thank you so much for being with us. And again, I'll put those links on Bank Information Center, Friends of the Earth, the Sierra Club, and I'll also put Groundwork.
We do have information on the Groundwork, but if people want to take action in the U.S., then these petitions go to elected officials in the Congress.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Susan.
Now, the United States is the largest World Bank funder, which means that if you live in the United States, it is your money and your life on the line. It also means that United States officials, particularly Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, have the power to intervene. Word has it that the pushback from civil society around the world is levering enough pressure that the U.S. is not an automatic shoe-in to vote for this loan. We need to apply pressure to ensure the right decision and direction. The World Bank is expected to vote on the loan at the April 8th meeting. A no vote from the U.S. could be all we need to stop this dirty, unjust loan from moving forward. To participate, to fill out a petition, or to get more information, there are several websites that you can go to. And these will be on our website, too, which is RaisingSandRadio.org. You can go to the Bank Info Center, the Bank Center Info, which is, these are all worldwide web, so BICUSA.org, Friends of the Earth, which is FOE.org, Sierra Club, which is SierraClub.org/South Africa, and Groundwork, which is groundwork.org.za. This is Raising Sand Radio, and I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, broadcasting a wide range of progressive views and ideas in collaboration with you. If you have a story or news of something going on in your community that you think the public should know about, send me an email at susan@raisingsandradio.org. And despite the woeful state of financial affairs all over, we at Raising Sand Radio have the balls to ask you to contribute to our work too. Why should you contribute to Raising Sand Radio rather than any other excellent project? Good question. But I will suggest, though, that Raising Sand Radio brings progressive ideas and themes from all over the world. As you know, if you listen in from a land far from the United States, say from Norway or from Armenia or South Africa or Russia or West Bank or Australia or Canada, we have listeners all over the place there. Raising Sand Radio, moreover, is a labor of love, but the dire circumstances are also a matter of survival. If you can't donate financially, donate time, or at least let us know that the work is appreciated. The website is RaisingSandRadio.org, and it has a PayPal button. We're fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. And again, the email is Susan@RaisingSandRadio.org. We just heard Sunita Dubey say that we the people are not hearing the full story about coal. I mentioned Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts referring to the four horsemen of climate change, Brazil, China, India, and South Africa. Let's take a quick tour of three of these countries, China, India, and South Africa, and see what's going on with their coal extraction. We begin with Channel 4's report on coal burning underground in China.
In China, one of the worst polluters, up to 3% of global carbon emissions come from its coal fires, raging in seams across the north. Our China correspondent Lindsay Hilson went to the Wuda coalfield in Inner Mongolia and to Urumqi in Xinjiang province to investigate.
Winter brings snow to Xinjiang in China's far west. But beneath the surface, the heat reaches 1,000 degrees. This is China's coal fire belt, where underground infernos send sulfur, soot, and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Bulldozers rake over the coals, trying to put out the blaze. Every year, China's coal fires are said to produce as much carbon dioxide as all the cars and trucks in America. Some fires started spontaneously hundreds of years ago, but others are sparked by unsafe mining practice, as China satisfies its endless hunger for coal.
Greenhouse gas emissions isn't just a problem for China. It affects the whole world. The Chinese government is under pressure to reduce emissions. So we firefighters are also under pressure to speed up our work to reduce emissions and environmental damage.
They pump water to lower the temperature. Later, they'll force mud and slurry through the cracks in the earth, to block the oxygen which keeps the coal burning. It takes months or years to put out a fire, but it may nonetheless be a more efficient way for China to cut emissions than by introducing energy-saving measures.
What these men do is really tough. The air is full of dirt and smoke and fumes from sulfur and other toxic gases. Working near the fire is boiling hot. But the work is really important, because with China's coal fires contributing up to 3% of global carbon emissions, extinguishing them could make a real difference.
Geologists monitor an area where a fire has been doused. They collect gas for testing. The fires produce methane and carbon monoxide. They check the temperature, still over 80 degrees. Not until it's under 70 degrees can they say a fire is well and truly extinguished. 1,500 miles away in Beijing, Professor Li Jing is teaching his students about a Sino-German project using remote sensing to identify coal fires.
When coal burns underground, the temperature rises on the surface. By using remote sensing imagery, especially thermal infrared technology, which is very sensitive to temperature, we can clearly locate the rising heat and quickly identify the fire area.
He's finding that the fires are spreading. In the Wuda coal field in Inner Mongolia, miners scrape the soil to expose a seam. A few meters below, where they've already extracted coal, fires burn unimpeded. So lucrative is coal, and China's demand so great that local authorities often turn a blind eye to illegal or slipshod mines.
The situation has worsened in the last few decades. In the 50s and 60s, coal mines were owned and operated by the state. Safety and fire prevention were a big part of a strict management regime, and there weren't many coal fires. But in the last few decades, many private mine businesses appeared, which ignore safety and fire prevention. As a result, we see fires everywhere now.
In Xinjiang, the firefighters have made a DVD about the biggest fire, Liuhanggou, which they extinguished 3 years ago. It used to burn up nearly 2 million tons of coal a year, a huge waste of natural resources, as well as a source of pollution. Now the land's recovering, vegetation's growing back. There's even a monument to thank the firefighters. But a few hundred yards away, we found fire burning once again. Here's the reason: tire tracks, and the telltale signs that small-scale miners have come, probably at night, to extract coal. They failed to replace the soil properly, and the fires restarted. Better policing is needed, and more money.
Once we detect coal fires, we need a lot of money to put them out. Private companies only think about profits. Only the state and the Xinjiang government have been putting funds into our work. It's taxpayers' money.
Another coal-fired power station, another few tons of climate-changing gas. China will come under more pressure to reduce its dependence on coal. Small, inefficient mines proliferate, despite the government's promise to close them down. To help meet its own target of reducing carbon emissions by 20% over 3 years, the Chinese government plans to extinguish more coal fires. But if they fail to control the way coal is mined, the efforts of the firefighters will be in vain. Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4 News, Xinjiang.
Another horseman of climate change is India, where financial investors will soon be able to own a slice of that country's largest coal mining company. Coal India Limited's initial public offering will hit markets in November or December of this year, albeit that the 10% stake that the government will sell in the market is all that investors will get to pick up. The Economic Times reports that the Indian government has already announced its plans of diluting 10% stake in unlisted companies, and Coal India Limited is in the list. And apart from the IPA, this coal major is looking for joint ventures in places like Australia, Indonesia, United States, and South Africa. With an investment of $1 billion to $1.5 billion for these joint ventures, Coal India's focus is to stabilize coal supply in India. Chairman of Coal India Limited, Mr. Bhattacharya, told Economic Times Now that, quote, our focus is to invest our funds in acquiring assets that deliver energy to our country and at the same time in a viable manner, unquote. Now we turn to South Africa and Sarah Belcher's video report, Undermined. You can find this full report on YouTube. Search using the keyword Undermined. There's also a link on our website at raisingsandradio.org.
Witbank Mpumalanga. More than 100 years of coal mining has left a bitter legacy. All that remains are abandoned mine dumps where unemployed women scavenge for scraps of usable coal. A small group of environmental activists is fighting this terrible legacy. One of them is Matthews Khlabane. The earth is now burning where coal was once dug from shallow mines. It sends up columns of smoke and poison water. There is no one left to blame. The mining magnates are long gone. The present government inherited the problem, but simply doesn't have the money to deal with it. The story of coal mining in Witbank is the story of a crime against nature. It is the story of the polluting of our water and the defiling of our land. It is the story of human tragedy. Matthews is visiting Tandi Mahlangu. She is one of the women who dig for coal on the old dumps. A little over a month ago, her son died. He was gathering coal in a deep trench when it collapsed. Tandi watched as he was crushed to death.
Everybody in this area used not to buy coal. They all went there to collect some coal. It was only if it's raining that they could buy food. But when it is not raining, they all go there to collect food.
The Witbank Council owns Coronation Dump. By law, it has to be rehabilitated. The question now is, whose responsibility is this?
It's a very serious problem for council because we have a vast amount of squatters squatting on that land. Those people are living the threat of cave-ins, and within the community where those people have been squatting, there's areas that have started to collapse, and they just move away from that area. And then they come to council and ask, you know, council, please, they need to move away from this area because it's dangerous. They want to move just a little bit further along where it looks safe. But the area that they're planning for, that they would like to move to, has got exactly the same potential for collapsing.
Nearly 50 years ago, the T&DB coal mine closed down. This company no longer exists, but its legacy remains. All around, the land is collapsing. Underground fires rage. In some places, they've been burning for decades. There is little hope of ever putting them out.
As being in charge of planning in Witbank, we are now faced with trying to integrate development of Witbank. But now to try and change that situation around is almost impossible because you've got these vast tracts of very open, beautiful land which are totally sterilized by this reasonably shallow undermining and undermining that's burning. Complicated by problems that people need to cross over. And I know there's cattle that graze in those areas. I believe cattle grazing on the T&DB site are quite happy and they're contented to live there and they grow strong and well. But if you bring a new cow from somewhere else and you put it on that site, it dies. I don't know. We're growing super breed of resistant cows in Witbank, you know.
Today, it's the government's responsibility to sort out the problems here and on the other 7 abandoned mines in the area.
The 10DP is a special case of a mine where the owner is liquidated and cannot be traced. So the state has taken responsibility of properly rehabilitating that particular mine. Studies has already been conducted on that mine.
We are actually waiting for the government to respond because they've conducted the study. They've paid the consultant, obviously some million, and we want them not to waste that money, but to go on practical action now.
We had a German delegation a few years back that came and gave us some idea of the enormity of the problem. Their thumbsuck estimations of reclaiming or rehabilitating all of the undermined areas, that's our land and other people's land. They thought it would be about R1 billion at that stage for a few years back.
I do believe that the government has got the money. It has to get the money. If one is to be controversial, for instance, if we do have money to buy arms, why can't we have money to fix problems like this?
Yes, I'm willing to speak about this because we need to get national sort of commitment to helping us with this problem because it's far beyond what the local council can manage.
We're not going to update that mine, you know, in a very short space of time. It is going to take some time.
In fact, the Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs hasn't made these coal mines a priority. They're putting their resources into rehabilitating asbestos mines in the Northern Cape.
Well, I just hope and pray that the asbestos problems are sorted out and then Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs could then swing their finances onto the Witbank problem and help us. We need it.
Makes me feel very, very angry, especially towards mining. We are told that the company cannot be traced. But I do believe that somewhere, somehow, the company, the owners, the previous owners do exist. The worst thing is the lies that we get from the mining. It's the lies. I mean, everything that they place before us is job creation, which, I mean, it's very good for us to have some jobs, but we say that they have to be sustainable. We rather shift our focus to something else which is sustainable. Mining industry is not sustainable, of course.
It was in the mid-80s that Matthews and his friends became aware of environmental issues. Many others were engaged in the anti-apartheid struggle. When a teacher began talking about the mines, their passions were aroused. Although this group has drifted apart, they still come together to fight the really big battles. And in Witbank, the biggest battle is water. The collapsed land creates tunnels for rain to run into. The water mixed with the pyrites and pollutants in the mine shafts is called acid mine drainage. It bubbles out of the earth, it's highly acidic, and kills almost everything in its path.
One of the things that we are trying to do is to first expose this species. So what we want to do is to make it not to be a behind-the-scenes area, but to be upfront, so that people could know about it, so that everybody, including those who market mining today, could know about the dangers of mining. And perhaps one could actually say this is one of the biggest crimes against nature to be committed by humans. Why can't we have those who have created such damage to nature to stand before justice and actually be if this be persecuted for the crimes that they've committed?
Those who committed this crime are long gone. It's now up to the state to deal with the mess they've left behind. And the worst part of this mess is that it doesn't stay here. The water flows into the spruits and rivers, finally ending up in the drinking water system.
We came from Cape Town to this place, and my wife said, first thing you buy is a filter, because this water tastes terrible. You know? But the people that live here like the water. I don't know. We drink filtered water. Don't hold that against me, but we do, you know.
Realizing just how serious the problem is, the Department of Water Affairs stepped in. They built this water purification plant a few years ago at a cost of over 40 million rand. It handles the acid mine drainage from TNDB and another neighboring mine. The plant is expensive to run, costing between 2 and 3 million rand annually. And the water that's released back into the Spruit is still not usable, even though it's been treated. The plan just doesn't seem to be working. To make matters worse, nothing is being done about the water pouring out of the other 7 mines in the area.
It's like the government trying to pick up from the ocean with a cup full of water, purify that water, and then release it into a stream, which is full of contaminated water. That's why when you look around this bank, you find that even the company managers still drive from this bank to other places. That's where they stay. They drive to this bank in the morning and back home in the afternoon. So they choose not to stay here. And only poor people, only those who actually don't understand, will prefer to stay around.
But we're making do at the moment. We're sorting it. You know, we're avoiding it. We're trying our best to put people where they are not going to be in danger. And Nero, what fiddles while Rome burns?
The legacy of mining in South Africa is not only confined to the area around Witbank. Polluted water also runs off gold mine dumps on the reef. If this pollution isn't carefully contained on the mine property, it can spill over into the surrounding areas.
That was an excerpt of Sarah Belcher's video report, Undermined. You can find her full video report on YouTube by searching on keyword Undermined. There's also a link to it on our website, raisingsandradio.org. Tuberculosis is generally considered to be linked to industrialization and urbanization. Peaking in the 1800s and receding slowly after that, the disease declined sharply in the West after World War II. TB has made a comeback in the last 20 years in developing countries such as China, India, and South Africa. An outbreak of extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, that is XDR-TB, in South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province recently gained the attention of the World Health Organization. Hundreds have been infected and the fatality rate is extremely high. Jerome Amir Singh, an HIV/AIDS expert at the Nelson R. Mandela School of Medicine, University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, said, and I quote, "The problem is a lot bigger than we know. The higher rates of normal TB and HIV infection here has created a very explosive disease cocktail." In a survey of TB patients last year, 51% of the XDR patients had no prior TB treatment, suggesting that they had been newly infected by the XDR TB strains. In less than 25 days, 52 of the 53 XDR TB patients died, a death rate unprecedented anywhere in the world. In a policy paper, XDR-TB in South Africa, No Time for Denialism or Complacency, in the Public Library of Sciences Journal, Singh and his colleagues write that, quote, "Given South Africa's international tourist boom and global trade and transport systems, the XDR-TB outbreaks represent a potentially explosive international health crisis." Unquote. Additionally, millions of migrant workers from neighboring countries like Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Lesotho, and Swaziland, and from different regions of South Africa, as well as high rates of HIV infection, create ideal conditions for the spread of XDR-TB. While South Africa has just begun to determine the extent of XDR-TB infections, neighboring countries are largely unaware of the problem and don't have the resources to test for the disease. Diagnosis of XDR-TB requires specialized labs and takes several weeks. "I wouldn't be surprised if it has spread to all the surrounding communities," Singh warned. "This could break the South African healthcare system." Now, we'll do more shows in the future on the healthcare system in South Africa, but I wanted to just tie together some of the diseases that one sees through industrialization and urbanization. And there you have it. Get involved by visiting our website, raisingsandradio.org, and linking to organizations and reports mentioned in this weekly show, broadcasting a wide range of progressive views and ideas in collaboration with you. Again, if you have a story or news of something going on in your community that you think the public should know about, send me an email, susan@raisingsandradio.org. And for another plug for Raising Sand Radio, please consider contributing to our work. Why should you contribute to Raising Sand Radio? Well, because Raising Sand Radio brings progressive ideas and themes from all over the world. As I mentioned earlier, we have listeners in Norway, Armenia, South Africa, West Bank, Israel, Russia, Australia, France, the UK. Moreover, Raising Sand Radio is a labor of love and concern for people over profit, but today's dire circumstances also make it a matter of survival. If you can't donate financially, donate time, or just let us know that our work is appreciated. The website is raisingsandradio.org, and we have a PayPal button there. Again, we're sponsored, fiscally sponsored by Peace Development Fund, and the email is susan@raisingsandradio.org. Now I'm going to play Louis Armstrong with What a Wonderful World to take us out and remind us why we do all of this hard work and all of this hard thinking. Have a great week.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I never knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.